Good morning, everyone. And I just wanted to echo Lynn and say thank you for braving the elements and making it here this morning. And I also want to thank the staff of the Policy Center, and in particular, Darcy Soss and Mary Perotti, for really helping to pull this event together here this morning. So as Lynn mentioned, this project was actually born out of numerous requests that the Policy Center received from organizations around the region who were interested in learning more about business tax incentives, and in particular, whether they are a cost-effective means of stimulating economic development. So I actually started this project last year, and as I dove into it, the economy took its own kind of dive and pulled along with it state tax revenue collections. And as this was happening, the importance of this issue really became more and more apparent to me. So in times of economic and fiscal stress, we have policymakers both at the state and the federal level who are interested in enacting policies that can help spur economic development and create new jobs. But at the same time, when states are facing large budget gaps, you know, there's really a concern for how well these different policies are working and what are we getting for the resources that we devote to them. Now, this paper tries to shed some light on these issues by synthesizing the information or the evidence on the effectiveness of business tax incentives and business tax credits in particular, and also tries to provide some analytical tools for trying to think about these issues. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the Policy Center's work, this is a good example of the types of things that we strive to do, which is to analyze an issue objectively, either through data analysis or by trying to provide a framework for policymakers to think about issues. And it's my hope that this paper and this forum today will really help policymakers as they grapple with these tough choices ahead of them. So I want to begin by defining business tax incentives. In short, these are preferences in the tax code that are used to encourage some type of business activity. Now, they can take on several different forms, but today we're going to be focusing mostly on tax credits. These are preferences that allow a taxpayer to reduce its tax liability by the amount of the credit on a dollar-for-dollar basis. And the amount of the credit, in turn, is usually tied to the level of the desired economic activity that the firm undertakes. Benefits of tax credits can, of course, include expanded economic activity, including increased state GDP, employment for state residents, and hopefully new jobs. On the cost side, tax incentives can be associated with revenue losses, which can translate to less money for other priorities. To measure the costs and benefits of a tax credit, we would ideally like to be able to compare what the world looks like with the credit in place versus what it would look like if the credit didn't exist. But unfortunately, the second scenario, which we've referred to as the counterfactual, is something that can't be observed. So this poses a challenge when you're trying to measure an incentive's true costs and benefits. And this is a point that I'm going to return to in a few moments. I had several specific aims in writing this report. First, I wanted to think about state tax credits in the context of some commonly accepted tax policy goals, such as equity or simplicity or competitiveness. Next, I wanted to catalog the different business tax credits that are offered in the New England states, and not simply list them, but to try to understand their different features and some of the ramifications of those features. To try to keep the project manageable, I focused on four specific types of business tax credits: credits for capital investment, for research and development, or R&D, for job creation, and for film production. And finally, I wanted to try to review the existing literature or the existing evaluations on these types of business tax credits to see what evidence there is on their effectiveness and their cost effectiveness. And in doing so, I tried to create a framework for how to think about these types of studies. So first I'm going to talk a little bit about how business tax credits fit in vis-a-vis some commonly accepted tax policy goals. Now I've listed up here six principles that I think most people would agree are important goals in a good tax system. And I'm going to just speak briefly about each one in turn and describe what it means and how business tax credits in general either support or undermine that goal. So first, equity refers to the fairness of the tax system. Unfortunately, it's kind of hard to determine who ultimately bears the burden of a business tax. It could be the business owners in terms of taking home fewer profits. It could be workers in terms of lower wages, or it could be a firm's customers in terms of paying higher prices. So because we can't tell that exactly, it's hard to tell who is ultimately bearing the burden and whether a business tax is truly equitable. And so by the same token, it's hard to tell who ultimately receives the benefits from a business tax credit. And so it's kind of hard to say whether they ultimately improve or reduce tax equity. A neutral tax system is one in which individuals and businesses make decisions based on their economic merits rather than tax considerations. In practice, a neutral tax system is really something that is hard to achieve. But tax credits, by their nature, tend to undermine this because they are an explicit attempt to use the tax system to induce some particular type of behavior. Simplicity refers to the ability of a tax system or the straightforwardness of a tax system. A simple tax system is one that is easy to understand and does not impose excessive burdens on either taxpayers or on tax administrators. And business tax credits tend to make the tax code somewhat more complex and more administratively burdensome. A transparent tax system is one in which it is easy to tell how a tax is being imposed and who is paying a certain tax. Tax credits also tend to reduce transparency, making it harder to determine, you know, which taxpayer is paying what and how much they are paying. Adequacy refers to the ability of a tax system to raise enough revenue to cover the costs of the desired mix and level of public services. And whether or not tax credits improve or reduce adequacy kind of depends on at least a couple of factors, one being whether the credit is associated with a net revenue loss. If the state is actually losing revenue, it might be harder to pay for the services that the residents want. But it also kind of depends on different people's views of what that correct mix of public services should be. And finally, a competitive tax system is one that helps a state to attract or retain individuals or businesses that otherwise might have located elsewhere. Tax credits can and probably do make a state's tax system more attractive, but whether or not they improve a state's overall competitive standing is a little bit harder to tell, because if you think about state governments having to potentially cut services in order to finance a tax credit, that could make a state less desirable for businesses or for individuals. So kind of the net effect of that is not, you know, entirely clear. This table lists some of the various credits that are offered by the New England states in these four types of these four categories that I'm looking at. As the table shows, most of the states in New England do seem to embrace tax credits as a way of trying to promote economic development, and some more so than others. Those of you who are familiar with tax credits in a particular state might think that I'm missing some things, and some of that is actually by design. For example, I did not include tax credits that are targeted at a particular geographic area. Something like an enterprise zone would be an example of this. Also, I tried to include credits that were actually credits or very similar to a credit in that they reduce a tax liability by a given amount. For example, I didn't include Rhode Island's job creation tax incentive, which is actually a corporate rate reduction. So it's sort of similar, but a little bit different. So that's why that is one is not up there. So five of the six states offer some sort of statewide credit for capital investment. And these credits usually cover things like equipment and machinery, in some cases buildings. All six states offer a credit for research and development, the most recent being Vermont, which I believe just enacted a credit this year, which will be going into effect in 2011. And research and development credits often will cover things like the salaries of individuals who are engaged in research or if the supplies that they use is in the research process. Four states offer statewide credit for job creation. And finally, four states offer credits for film production, which will cover things like the salaries paid to the cast and crew of a film or the goods and services that are used in the film production process. And the report itself, which you should have all received a copy of on your chair, I include several detailed tables that provide more information on each of these tax credits, including some of their features. Now, as the tables in the report will show, the policymakers who designed all these credits had a lot of choices to make when they decided how to structure them. So I'm going to highlight some of these choices here. One of the first choices is to decide what type of economic activity a credit will try to induce. And this can be either explicit or implicit. So, for example, with a film tax credit, they're explicitly trying to induce more film production in a state. But implicitly, they could also be trying to encourage more publicity for the state and hopefully more tourism. In designing tax credits, policymakers must also decide which firms are going to receive the credits. And also how they're going to distribute the credits once they determine eligibility. So most credits will have some sort of eligibility requirements, and this could be that credit is restricted to a particular industry or set of industries. It could be that firms are required to engage in some minimum level of activity in order to receive a credit. So to give you a few examples from New England, the investment tax credits offered by both Massachusetts and Rhode Island are restricted to particular industries. So in Massachusetts, only firms that I think are in manufacturing, R&D, life sciences, agriculture, and commercial fishing are eligible for these types of credits. Credits can be either entitlements or they can be discretionary. An entitlement basically means that any firm that meets the eligibility requirements can receive a credit. With a discretionary credit, the state actually will evaluate an application that is submitted and, you know, award the credits on a discretionary basis. And so this allows the state to really, it gives them the opportunity to judge a project or a firm based on its merits. But as you can imagine, it does increase the administrative burden, both for the firm that usually has to put together some type of application package, and also for the state who has to review those and then make the decisions. And for a couple examples of discretionary incentives, the Vermont Employment Growth Incentive, or VEGI, is a discretionary program, and the Connecticut Jobs Creation Credit also has a discretionary element where the applications must be approved on a case-by-case basis. Credits can be open-ended, meaning that there's no limit to the total amount of credits that can be granted, or they can be capped, either in an aggregate sense or on a per-credit basis. So, for example, the New Hampshire R&D tax credit has an aggregate cap of $1 million per year, and each individual firm can only receive up to $50,000 per year. And this really tries to keep the cost of the credit down for the state. Another consideration is how the credit will be calculated for each firm. And this is usually done by multiplying a predetermined credit rate by the firm spending on qualified activity, however that may be defined. And higher rates and broader definitions of qualified activity can make a credit more attractive to firms, but it can also increase the cost to the state, particularly if credits turn out to be subsidizing activity that might have already taken place or would have taken place regardless. There may be times when the credit that is calculated by whatever formula is in place actually exceeds the liability of the tax or of the firm itself. And so in these situations, credits will often include some sort of provision that allows the taxpayer to retain at least some of the value of the credit that they might otherwise lose if it was bound to their tax liability. And one common means of doing this is carry-forward provisions. These are provisions that allow a firm to hold on to any unused portion of their tax credit and apply it to tax liabilities in future years. And carry-forwards are actually quite common across the various types of tax credits that I looked at in this paper. Another possibility is to make the credit either transferable or refundable. And this is particularly common among film tax credits, especially at least here in New England. And the reason for this is that many of the film production companies that come here to shoot movies often do not have a significant corporate tax liability. So without features like this, the credit would not be that attractive to them. A transferable credit is one in which the original recipient can sell any unused portion of its credit to another taxpayer who can then apply that credit to its own tax liability. And the taxpayer that purchases the credit doesn't necessarily need to be in the same industry. So with these types of credits, the state may end up subsidizing industries that have nothing to do with the industry that they're originally trying to target. Now, refundable credits are slightly different. With a refundable credit, the state can actually get cash back, the taxpayer can actually get cash back from the state for the portion of the tax credit that exceeds its tax liability. So, for example, the Massachusetts film tax credit is refundable at 90%, which means that if a production company had a tax credit that was worth $100,000, but they had zero tax liability in the Commonwealth, they could receive $90,000 from the state. Although, from what I understand, the Massachusetts credit is both transferable and refundable, and my understanding is that most firms tend to sell it rather than refund it or have it refunded. Another consideration for those designing tax credits is whether or not to include a recapture or a clawback provision. And these are provisions in the credit that allow a state to get back some of the credit that it gave out if the firm does not live up to it did not deliver what it said it was going to do. So, for example, the Connecticut Fixed Capital Investment Credit requires that firms keep in place or keep in service in the state the whatever machinery or equipment that they purchase for at least 5 years. So if a company buys a machine and receives a tax credit associated with that purchase and then pulls that machine out of service in Connecticut after, say, 3 years, they would have to pay back some portion of the credit they received. And so this is one way that states can try to ensure that they are getting, you know, they're actually getting some bang for their buck. So we've looked at some of the tax credits that are offered in New England, and I've considered some of the choices that policymakers faced in designing those credits. And now I'd like to go over several key questions that are important in the evaluation of tax credits. Now, the first question is probably the most basic, and that is, does the credit induce the targeted activity? And as I mentioned before, to answer this question, you'd really like to be able to compare what the world looks like with the credit in place versus what it would have looked like without the credit. But unfortunately, we can't observe this counterfactual. So because of that, analysts usually either have to assume what the counterfactual would look like, or they perform some type of estimation to estimate the incremental activity that is actually attributable to the credit. The second question is, what is the credit's overall economic impact? And this can actually include both direct effects and indirect effects. So you can think of direct effects as the changes in economic activity by the firm that is actually receiving the credit. Indirect effects can actually take on several different forms, and they can be either positive or negative. So to give you a couple of examples, consider a firm that receives a tax credit and as a result hires a bunch of new workers. Those new jobs would be considered a direct effect of the credit. Now, say those workers tend to all eat their lunch at the restaurant next door. The restaurant has more business. They might have to hire an additional cook. They might have to hire more wait staff. That new business and those new jobs would be considered an indirect effect of the credit. Now, as I mentioned before, credits could also have negative indirect effects. So, for example, if a firm that is not eligible for a credit is now at a disadvantage relative to firms that are subsidized, and if they have to scale back their operations and lay some people off, those would be negative indirect effects. We can also see negative effects if the state has to lay off workers. So many states in the U.S., or almost all, except I think for Vermont, have at least some form of a balanced budget requirement. And so if a credit has an expected revenue loss, the state usually must either offset that by reducing its spending or raising other taxes. And those can have negative effects on the economy. Another question is, what is the credit's fiscal impact? So the previous question kind of looked at some of the benefits associated with a tax credit, and this is more along the lines of what is the credit's cost. So the fiscal impact is generally measured as the new revenue that is generated as a result of expanded economic activity stemming from the credit. So, for example, if a credit leads to new jobs, this can translate into new income tax revenue for the state, assuming the state has a personal income tax. And this can offset some of the initial or gross cost of the credit. So, for example, if a state granted $5 million in tax credits, that would be the gross cost. But if those credits led to new economic activity, which in turn generated $2 million in new revenues, the net cost to the state would be the difference. It would be 5 minus 2 or $3 million. Now, to be thorough, any analysis should also try to consider what changes in government spending may occur as the result of a tax credit. And these could also go either way. So, for example, if there's expanded economic activity, there might be fewer people in the state who require use of safety net programs that the state offers. So state spending could go down in that sense. On the other hand, you know, expanded economic activity could lead to population growth, which could lead to a greater need for different services, you know, education, police protection, and so forth. So the net effect of that is a little unclear. And it seems to be the case that in practice, a lot of studies don't try to measure that directly, but focus mostly on the revenue impact of a credit. And finally, pulling together the benefits and the costs, we can ask, is the credit cost effective? Now, cost effectiveness usually refers to how much it costs to achieve a fixed outcome. So, for example, how much does it cost to create a new job? Another way to look at it would be how much of a fixed outcome could you generate or how much of a given outcome could you generate for a fixed cost? So sometimes you'll see measures like the personal income that is generated in a state per dollar of credit that is granted. In either case, I think it's really important to ask cost-effective relative to what? Now, this could be relative to a standard threshold, if such a threshold exists. For example, several federal programs, such as the Housing and Urban Development, I think it's the Community Development Block Grant Program, has a threshold of $35,000 per permanent full-time job. And so if we were to use this threshold, if a state-level tax credit was associated with a net revenue loss of $50,000 per each job created, we would say that credit was not cost-effective relative to this measure. And ideally, one would want to compare the cost-effectiveness of a particular tax credit with the cost-effectiveness of other programs and policies that are designed to achieve similar goals. And this way, the state would be able to see what is really giving them the biggest bang for the buck. So with this framework in mind, I identified evaluations for each of the four types of tax credits. Identified evaluations that attempted to answer at least one of these four questions. In total, I reviewed about 30 different studies, and these included several studies that used data from multiple states to try to estimate the average impact of a particular type of credit on its targeted activity. I also included studies that looked at or tried to evaluate the effectiveness or cost effectiveness of a credit in one particular state. And here I was particularly interested in New England-based studies, and so I included all of those that I could find. But because they were somewhat few and far between, I also included some studies from other states outside the region to try to round things out. Now, the studies that I looked at used different methodological approaches, but in general, they fell into three different categories. We had some descriptive studies that usually try to take information from tax credit applications or tax returns and summarize that information, do some calculations, try to get at cost effectiveness in a sort of rudimentary manner. There were a number of econometric studies which used regression analysis and other techniques, usually to try to isolate the impact of tax credits on their targeted activity or on overall economic activity. And finally, there were a number of so-called input-output studies. And these studies rely on special models that are able to project how changes in one part of the state's economy flow through to the rest of the economy. So these are pretty good for capturing both direct and indirect effects. And another benefit of these studies is that a lot of them also will try to capture the fiscal impact of a credit. So because they're looking at both the benefits and the costs, they allow for estimates of cost effectiveness. So what did I find from this review? So first, the evidence does suggest that the selected credits do seem to foster their targeted activity. So in other words, levels of capital investment, R&D, job creation, and film production appear to be higher with credits in place than they would be if the credits did not exist. But there are a couple of important points to note. One is that there is evidence that state-level credits simply shift activity around from state to state without necessarily increasing the overall level of activity from a national perspective. So state X gains a bunch of jobs, state Y loses that same amount of jobs, the net effect is around zero. Another important point is that a lot of the activity, or at least some of the activity that is subsidized by credits, probably would have occurred anyway. And this provides what is known as a windfall to the taxpayer, because they're receiving some sort of benefit for things that they would have been doing even if there was no credit for it. The evidence from the literature also reiterated that it is important to consider both direct and indirect effects, because the indirect effects can be sizable. And so this just suggests that descriptive studies that only try to capture the direct effects are really not capturing the whole picture. And so you just have to be a little bit cautious when reading these types of studies and understand what their limitations are. The literature also suggests that business tax credits do not tend to pay for themselves, meaning the new revenue that is generated in most cases does not seem to offset the initial cost of the credit. And so this means that states are really devoting resources to these credits, and so it's important to understand what benefits they are getting for those resources. But unfortunately, with the existing literature, it's difficult to draw clear conclusions on cost effectiveness. And there are a few different reasons for this. One is that there are just some limitations in the existing studies that are out there. And there's also relatively few head-to-head comparisons of tax credits with other types of initiatives. Now, obviously, you can try to compare cost effectiveness across different studies. But again, I would recommend exercising some caution with doing that, because different researchers use different assumptions, and it won't always be an apples to apples comparison. So you just have to be a bit careful when doing that. And then finally, assumptions do matter. They can have a big impact on the magnitude of the estimates and the conclusions that you draw from them. So, for example, some of the studies that I looked at that found the most favorable impacts for tax credits, or the most favorable cost-effectiveness measures, also tended to failed to adjust for a state's balanced budget requirement, for example, or they didn't take into consideration potential windfalls to taxpayers. And so, for this reason, I think it's really important to closely examine existing studies and to understand what assumptions the authors are making and what the potential limitations might be. Now, before I close and turn things over to the panel, I just want to offer some concluding thoughts. And one of the problems that has historically plagued the evaluation of business tax credits has been a lack of data. Now, as more and more states requiring the collection and dissemination of data on tax credits and other incentives. I'm hopeful that this will lead to higher quality studies, which will hopefully allow us to offer or allow us to draw some sounder conclusions on their cost effectiveness. In the meantime, I just want to reiterate that policymakers and other stakeholders should really try to understand the strengths and weaknesses of existing studies when using them to inform the tax credit debate. And I'll conclude by saying that it is also important to consider the larger picture. Cost effectiveness is definitely important, but we also need to think about how tax credits fit in relative to other tax policy goals. And it's also essential to consider who is benefiting from these credits and how are they benefiting. So, for example, if a credit does lead to new jobs, who is it that's filling these jobs? Is it state residents that were previously unemployed? Is it people from out of state who are commuting in? And sort of what's the quality of the jobs that are created? Do they offer good pay and benefits? Are they permanent? So I think these are also important questions to ask when determining the role of tax credits in state economic development policy. So at this point, I would just like to thank you for your time and attention, and I'm going to turn the floor over to our panel, which I think will provide a very lively and thought-provoking discussion. So I'd like to invite Bob Tannenwald, who is our panel moderator, and our panelists up to the table. And following the discussion, I will be available along with the panelists to take questions from the audience. So I look forward to having that dialogue. Thank you.